So finally, this isn't perhaps too relevant, but it interests me. they advised with an Amsterdam friend and asked what they could do now that they couldn't find the Amsterdam owners of this boat, what they should do with the 2,000 pounds. And the advice was, of this friend, that to establish a free school for the poor children of Amsterdam might be as good a thing as they could do under the circumstances. So if you go to Amsterdam today, you'll see that school, built in 1823. I can give you the address on Berenstraat. It's called the John Warder School. That was my ancestor's name. It has, you know, these Amsterdam buildings, tall and straight with a big gable. It has at the top, on the very top of the gable, a model of a ship. The boat is called after the ship that was captured, the Amsterdamische Welvaren, that is the Amsterdam Welfare. And you'll find the initials JW on the front of the school and the account inside of how the thing got founded. A rather astonishing story. You won't find many monuments erected to people that refused to take part in war. You'll find a good many erected to people that did. This is a sample of the reformers. I've already mentioned, I think, one other minor implication of the peace testimony, and that is, if you don't approve of war, you can't rejoice with your fellow citizens in a military victory, in which hundreds of the enemy have been slain and your country has won a victory. It was customary, after a victory, to illuminate the houses with candles at night. And the Quakers regularly would not put candles in their front windows. And therefore, the mob came along and seen that these were unpatriotic people, smashed the windows of the Quaker houses. But this was a consistent result. I think you see how this attitude towards war seemed to be completely unloyal, disloyal. And the Quakers were suspected for two other reasons, weren't they, of insubordination. One was their refusal to take an oath of allegiance, although they would make an affirmation of allegiance. And the other was their refusal of the certain courtesies, flattering titles to government officials. So that when you add to that their pacifism, they were trebly suspected of disloyalty, of lack of patriotism. I'll read you another story. This took place in America at the time of the War of 1812 and took place in Tennessee. There was a Quaker preacher from Vermont, his name was Joseph Hoag, was visiting down there. You know how the Quaker preachers traveled around and visited friends all over. And he was staying in a hotel at Knoxville when a number of soldiers came in, including the general. I'm quoting now from Joseph Hoag's journal. The sergeants made their returns to the general that they had warned every man that the law required to do military duty, Quakers and all, and there had not one Quaker appeared on the training ground. That is, they were supposed to come out and drill. The general was down there protecting the country against the inroads of the Indians and against possible other dangers. I take it that the Quaker and the general were easily distinguished by their uniform, each other, without introduction. The general looked sharply at me as I was walking the room and said, "Well, we've lost a number of our frontier inhabitants and some of our soldiers, and the people will not defend the frontier inhabitants when the savages are destroying and scalping men cannot be considered friends to their country, and should have no favor from him. He then said to me, how do you like this doctrine, stranger? I answered, it is no doctrine for me. I have little or no opinion of it. The general, unused to such opposition, asked, why? And then Hoag explained the Quaker position, that it was taken in obedience to the commands of Christ, and they owned supreme allegiance to Christ as the soldier owns supreme allegiance to his earthly commander. The general sat down and soon rose with these words, I'm not going to give up the argument so. I see by the look of your eye that you are no coward. You are a soldier. And if an Indian were to come into your house to kill your wife and children, you would fight. I answered, as for cowardice, I ever despised it. But pointing to the guns standing in the house with bayonets on them and looking him full in the face, I added, General, it would take 12 such men as thou art, and then you would not do it, to make me take hold of a gun or pistol to take the life of a fellow Christian, a fellow creature. He turned and sat down, but not long, and said, I will bring you to the point. If an Indian were to come into your house with his knife and tomahawk, and you knew he would kill you, your wife and children, and you knew that you could kill him and save all, you would kill him. If you did not, you would be guilty of the death of the whole. Very common argument. If you don't fight, you're guilty for the... That is, you're not killing directly, but you're letting other people kill. I thought it time to look for a close. And told him I should keep him to the Christian platform or creed laid down by Jesus Christ, and that he would not deny that a Christian was fit to live or die. I then told him I would give the subject a fair statement, and he might judge. I proceeded thus. I shall state that myself and wife are true Christians, and our children are in their minority, and thou knowest it's natural for children to believe what their parents teach them. And therefore we are all true Christians as far as our several capacities enable us to be. And now the question is this. Which is most like the precepts and example of our King, the author of the Christian religion? To lay down our lives and all go to heaven together, or kill that Indian and send him into eternity? For he must be wicked to kill a family that would not hurt him. General, it is a serious thing to take the lives of those who are not prepared to die. They have no chance to come back and mend their ways. And thou dost not know but that if that Indian was spared, he might feel remorse enough to make him repent so as to find forgiveness. And that is not all, General. When I killed that Indian, I imbrued my hands in human blood. Canst thou make thyself believe that I stand as good a chance to get to heaven as to die with my hands were clean and I innocent of human blood? And General, we find Jesus Christ had one soldier among his followers who drew his sword and fought like a valiant for his Lord. But what then said his Lord? Put up again thy sword into its place, for all they that take the sword shall perish by the sword. General, thou wilt do well to remember that saying. It is the word of a king. The general made no answer, but sat and hung his head for some time. One of the company of soldiers said at length, well, stranger, if all the world was of your mind, I would turn and follow after. I replied, so then thou hast a mind to be the last man in the world to be good. I have a mind to be one of the first and to set the rest an example. This made the general smile. After a little discourse, the general said, well, stranger, there are a great many of your sort of people in this state. I answered, yes, and I hope thou finds them an honest, industrious, peaceable people, good inhabitants to populate and clear up the new country and make it valuable. He said, yes, they are an industrious, harmless people. We're both now on our feet. I turned and looked him full in the face and spoke with some emphasis. General, Canst thou say then, an honest, industrious people who will harm nobody are enemies to their country? He paused a while and said, no, and they shall have my protection, and you have the word of a general for it. I then felt easy that all was done that could be done. I had the same man's word who had said, no favor shall be shown to the Quakers, now pledge his honor to protect them. After some more conversation, we parted very pleasantly.
Yeah. How could that Quaker accept the protection of a general who is going to use force and violence to protect him?
Well, I didn't ask him. Apparently nobody asked him. The answer to that I think some of you could probably try to answer that for yourselves. Isn't it very doubtful whether the military method is, in the average, a good way to be protected? Are there not better ways to secure protection? How did Pennsylvania get on for 75 years without any military protection, even against the Indians? Well, it's a perfectly right question. A pacifist doesn't want to be protected by force of arms. You may remember some years ago when there was military trouble in China, and the missionaries up the Yangtze were sent an American gunboat to protect them. They wrote to the government and they said, we don't want to be protected by an American gunboat. Well, if you're going to argue this on the basis of what is the real protection, you'd have to have a great many statistics of various kinds, wouldn't you? And have to compare great many incidents. At one thing, at least, I think the general could protect the Quakers from, and the Quakers would accept it. He would protect them from being conscripted. He would protect them from their own government, if he could. Well, we've already seen from these things that the Quakers were sometimes, although their position was perhaps not in the first instance an argued, logical position, they often had arguments to meet. And all I can say about the pacifist position is that there's no argument can be brought against it that hadn't been brought over the last hundreds of years. Therefore, while the Quakers may not know all the answers, they may know all the questions. Because they know. You know that story that Hugh Morton said about the old maid that looked as though she knew all the answers, but nobody had ever asked her the right questions. Well, it didn't quite that understand, but you get my point. What are some of the questions? Of course, we've already mentioned the biblical argument. Christians, of course, love to quote the Bible. I came not to send peace but a sword. That's Jesus. Of course, God telling the Old Testament Israelites to go out and kill, indicating that even God himself took part in the war and helped the Israelites win, all that sort of thing. He was called the Lord of hosts, wasn't he, which means armies in the Old Testament. The duty of obeying one's government. That's one of the arguments. Is it an absolute duty? Paul seems to think so. The powers that be are ordained of God. Therefore, you should show honor and obedience. That's the gist of it. Is there no exception? I happened to be in Norway just after the end of the German occupation the Nazis and by Quisling. And I was talking about, the work of the American Friends Service Committee, and some of the theological students there said to me, how can you reconcile that with the teaching of the Apostle Paul? Well, Norway had for years quietly disobeyed the orders of the German government in control of Norway. And I think I said to the questioner, I was surprised to have that question asked at this time in this place. I'd heard it before. But these people who had consistently done all they could, underground and everything else, to disobey the orders of the government. It was, for the time being, the government of Norway, but it wasn't the Norwegian government or one they loved. Of course, if you say, well, I'll obey the government, and it's perfectly clear the government's wrong, but in these complicated matters, probably the government knows best. That's a very common view. The government knows best. Well, they have information, but they have also certain interests and tendencies which we're long used to. Anyone who's lived through as many wars as I have just knows what the government can do. For instance, in 1898, when we were just spoiling for a war with Spain, and when an ultimatum had been sent to the Spanish government, and the Spanish government had accepted our ultimatum, and the cable accepting it from our ambassador was already in the president's pocket, without mentioning that acceptance, he went before Congress and asked for a declaration of war, 1898. Well, the government always knows best, does it? I happened to be in England in 1956 when England and France attacked Egypt along with Israel, in spite of the fact that they had agreed to ally against the aggressor between Egypt and Israel. And the Premier, Anthony Eden, asked for a declaration of war. And the Secretary for Foreign Affairs, the civil servant that knew just the same papers that Anthony Eden knew, resigned from his office out of protest. The government knows best. John Bright once said, looking back over 200 years of English history, we find that we have gone to war mostly for reasons that shouldn't have been listened to at the time. So that this argument, which you get again and again, I'm not so sure. Nothing in recent years makes me think that our government will not lie and be deceived, both. So that's the way you have to deal with that kind of argument. Another argument is, if the government orders you to do it, then you're not morally responsible. Here's what was written at the time of the Mexican War by James Russell Lowell. As for war, I call it murder. There you have it plain and flat. I don't need to go no further than my testament for that. If you take a sword and draw it and go stick a fella through, government ain't to answer for it. God will send the bill to you. That is, responsibility for engaging in war cannot be passed on to the government. Well, those are some of the questions that you have to, a pacifist has to meet, yes?
How does a pacifist rationalize the fact that if they pay taxes, say the government comes and collects taxes? I mean, you mentioned the case of the person who tried to keep the money in a bank, say, and the government comes and takes them. Well, now, the Quaker has done something to prevent the use of his money for war.
He hasn't done anything, but he's come nearer to trying to prevent it than other people have to pay it long term.
Does this absolve one, the fact that
no, it doesn't absolve him. It's not at all a satisfactory situation. My sister did this for many years. And she found every year that very politely an officer of the government come around and say, I've just collected from the local bank. Sure, they have fine, the Treasury Department has fine, courteous people that do the very best they can, but that doesn't dissolve itself. No, there is no satisfactory solution. Unless, as I say, you keep your income down. I know people that have done that. I've known people that have at least gotten some satisfaction out of paying as much to some peace organization as the government has stolen from them for war purposes. That's not much satisfaction either. Something.